right, Mark chapter 12 is where we are at. Verse 28 in particular. Yesterday, we talked about the first two of the series of three challenges that we find in chapter 12 that will lead into a counterattack, and we'll deal with the third and the counterattack today, that will then follow into a discussion about the widow's offering. In particular, though, what were the first two attacks launched about? What was it launched over? Say it again.
Taxes.
Initially, it was the taxes. By what? By whom? I guess I should say. By who? Pharisees and the Herodians. Exactly right. And that one, we talked about, how was Jesus' response? What did Jesus say in response to what they were saying? Yeah, why would you want to keep it anyway? I'm very confused. Why don't you just give it to the guy that wants it? Because ultimately it has a blasphemous image on it anyway. Do you want to be his disciple? Is that why you're keeping it? So finally the Pharisees say, wow, good answer. He says, give to Caesar's what is Caesar's, give to God's what is God's. And then comes on the scene the Sadducees. And what do they ask their question about? The resurrection, which is odd because they don't even believe in a resurrection. And in particular, what resurrection issue do they bring up? Yeah, marriage. In particular, this cursed, barren woman who has seven husbands consistently are dying, and now, he asked, at the resurrection, which one stuck with her? That's the question that's being asked. And Jesus responds, according to the way I am seeing it, through the honor and shame situation, trying hard to define marriage the way they defined it, instead of the way in which we defined it, that ultimately what Jesus is saying is that the issue about who is stuck with her, the answer is God, because he takes care of everyone anyway. He says, but that's kind of the key problem of my ministry as well as your own, is you're consistently fighting for what you want, or you're frustrated with what you're stuck with. So, but ultimately in my kingdom, God takes care of it all, even in the afterlife. And then he looks at him and he says, and you know, you have another problem. Not just that you demean this woman and don't trust God, but you even underestimate his power whenever you deny there's a resurrection. He says, let's go to the books that you actually believe in, the books of Moses. At the burning bush, in the present tense, it says, I am the God of Jacob, of Isaac, of Abraham. But those people had already died. So if he is currently their God, it means he's the God of the living and not of the dead. He looks at him and says, man, you're badly mistaken on multiple accounts. So the Pharisees, the Herodians, and the Sadducees all launching their honor attack on Jesus, trying to trip him up because they weren't too excited about his cleansing of the temple, not all that excited about the parable he just told about them where he said the kingdom's taken away from you and given to someone else. And then we come to our third I say the word attack with quotation marks. And the reason why I say with quotation marks is because it is in the series of two other attacks, therefore that could somewhat define what this interaction is. Nevertheless, the way in which the guy approaches and the guy's ultimate response makes me wonder how malicious the intent is behind this inquiry. In Mark. In Matthew, I don't have much of a question. As a matter of fact, Matthew chapter 22, 34 through 35 says, hearing that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, the Pharisees got together once again. One of them, an expert in the law, tested him with a question. Matthew doesn't really leave much gray. He says it's another test, it's another attack. Mark, it's not as clear. However, I will say this. In an honor-shame culture, even a compliment in public can be an attack by someone. Can be a challenge on someone. Why? Why is it that a compliment in public could be considered an attack? How does that make any sense at all? It could be mocking them. Maybe the tone of voice. What else?
You have to live up to it.
He would have to live up to it. Yeah, what if? What if you walk up and I look up to Chad, I go to Chad and I'm saying, hey Chad, we're in an honor shame culture. I say, man, you're amazing. You're even better than the emperor. What have I just done? I've given him honor. It was a compliment. But ultimately, what has it done to Chad?
Made him a target.
Yeah, now he's a target. He's in a vulnerable position. In an honor-shame culture, if you single someone out of the community and exalt them to a level that they should not be, that is not a good thing for them. It is a threatening thing to both that person and their community. So even a compliment in public, matter of fact, Bruce Molina in his book, The New Testament World, says every interaction in public, every interaction, honor and shame are at war. Every interaction. So the fact that this guy comes up and asks Jesus in public something, even though he may do it in a way that seems benign, the very fact he is doing it says that whether that's his intention or not, honor is at stake. Are you following me? So I'm not saying this guy has malicious intent. Nevertheless, he would know the rules of the game. And even if you're nice to someone in public, you are saying, honor's at war here. Even a compliment. Are you following me? So I think that what Matthew is saying probably isn't too far from the truth, and yet, ultimately, I do think that it is even more shameful to the Pharisees when this guy almost converts. And we'll talk about what he's missing once we get there. All right. One of the teachers of the law came and heard them debating. Noticing that Jesus had given them a good answer, he asked him. Now right there, you could even suggest the reason why he asked him a question is not because he just wants more good answers. Because he's saying, wow, that guy has won the honor war. And if I want to win honor, if I ask him a question he can't answer that well or he doesn't answer well, then I get it. I'm not saying that is his intent. I'm saying it's possible. It is his possible intent. Are you following me? So I'm not accusing this guy of anything malicious, but an honor-shame culture, even something that seems benign, you can't take that at face value. Oh, you're better than the emperor. Oh, you jerk. You see how that works? Everybody following me? Yeah, are we awake? Hello? All right, good. I know it's warm in here, but it's not hot, so we can stay awake, yes? And I am okay as if you're falling asleep, if you just go and stand in the back of the room, I'm cool with that. It actually helps you stay awake if you're standing. If you fall asleep while you're standing, well, that's a whole other problem. So I won't be held liable to that. Okay. He asked him, of all the commandments, which is the most important? Give me one. Jesus says, well, I'll give you one, but I'll actually give you two. The most important one, answered Jesus, is this. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all of your mind and with all of your strength. Let's stop right there. Where does that come from? Say it again. Deuteronomy chapter 6, known as what? The Great Shema. Deuteronomy chapter 6 is huge. It's huge. Because it literally is the definition of the relationship between God and His people. Deuteronomy chapter 6 comes after the great Exodus. It comes after the Ten Commandments are delivered to the people in chapter 5. Deuteronomy chapter 6 then is giving them instructions right before they are going to be moving into this deep relationship with God. It's an identity passage. Matter of fact, I'm going to read to you Deuteronomy chapter 6, I think verses 1 through about 6, because I want you to get the context of what Jesus is saying here. Okay? Everybody following me? Okay. These are the commands, decrees, and the laws the Lord your God directed me to teach you, to observe in the land that you are crossing the Jordan to possess, so that you, your children, and their children after them may fear the Lord as long as you live, by keeping all His decrees and commands that I give you, and so that you may enjoy a long life. Okay, so you see the context of why He's giving them more? He's saying you're crossing the Jordan, you're entering into a land that has been promised to you because you are God's people, you are His. And this is what He says, Hear, O Israel, and be careful to obey so that it may go well with you and that you may increase greatly in a land flowing with milk and honey. There's a latent threat there. I don't know if you heard it. So that it may go well with you. Just as the Lord, the God of your fathers, promised you. And then He says, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul and with all of your mind. Or with all of your strength, excuse me. I was adding in what Jesus says in Matthew. These commandments that I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Phylacteries, anyone? Remember the practice by the Jews even today of having the black box on their wrist and even on their foreheads? Why? It comes from this passage. It's an identifying factor of who they belong to. Just one of the reasons why whenever the mark of the beast is put on the forehead and their hands should not shock us. Because ultimately it's an identifying factor of who you belong to. That makes sense? Comes from this passage. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. When the Lord your God brings you into the land He swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give to you, a land with large, flourishing cities that you did not build, houses filled with all of good things that you did not provide. Who provided them? You see the issue? We're coming off of a passage about who's going to be stuck with this woman having to provide for her. And Jesus quotes a passage that in context, the entire relationship with Israel has constantly been based on what God has provided for them. Wells you did not dig, and vineyards and olive groves you did not plant. Then when you eat and are satisfied, be careful that you do not forget the Lord who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. Do you notice the whole point of Deuteronomy 6? The whole point is to say, I've not just given you a list of rules in chapter 5 with the Ten Commandments. I've not just given you a list of things to obey. It's one of the things I am getting more and more frustrated with the way in which we talk about the law. The law of the Jews that you know, for us is an allergic thing. No, it's not. No, it's not. It's a beautiful thing. Now, ultimately, it isn't what Jesus gave us. But it isn't something that we can just throw mud at. The law is something that gave the identity to the people of God, that was cultivating their relationship. And then ultimately, if they would have stayed within the confines of that law, the relationship would have flourished. So don't act like the law is just something to constantly break or get frustrated with. It really is something that can be beautiful. It's only ugly if you don't want to obey it. Ultimately, though, the instructions he gives in Deuteronomy 6 is to have this belief, this command, love the Lord your God with all of your heart, soul, mind, and strength, so infused to every part of your life, every part, on your door frames, on your hands, on your head, when you lie down, when you get up, when you walk, when you run, tell it to your children, tell it to your children's children, to your wife, everyone. This defines you. This is your identity. And it is all rooted in His identity. Are you seeing how this works? What is the command that Jesus gives them? Rely totally on God for absolutely everything. And the Jews in the background would have given out a hearty amen, even though their actions betray that they really don't believe what He just said. But this meant so much to the Jews that they would even recite the great Shema every day. Love, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, with all your mind and with all your strength. They're very familiar with this passage, reciting it. Not as familiar living it. And I think that you can make the application to your own life here at Ozark based on that last comment. Right? Man, some of you are so good at reciting the Bible. Some of you are so good at taking tests, no matter what class it's in. Some of you are even really good at writing papers. And you're not living any of this out. And so I think Jesus would look at you, and frankly, I'll look at you and say, so I don't stinking care how much of the Bible you have memorized. That doesn't impress me. That doesn't impress Him. That's not what He wants. He's not opposed to it. It's just that if you think that that's your burnt offering, He looks at you and says, I don't want your offerings. I want you to do what it says, not just you be able to recite what I have written. Do what it says. And that's where the odd next phrase comes. The second is this, verse 31. Now, Matthew says something explicitly that Mark only says implicitly. Matthew 22:39 says, and the second is like the first. Do you hear that language? Does that strike you weird at all? What would be the natural question before you even got to what the second one is? What would be the natural question to ask once you heard, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength? And then you hear somebody say, oh, and the second commandment's just like the first one. What would your thought be? Yeah, what could be on the same level? What could be like the first? What is like loving the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your mind, with all your soul, with all your strength? What is even like that command? And Jesus says, well, love your neighbor as yourself. That's like the first one. Jesus is quoting Leviticus 19, verse 8. That's a good test question. Leviticus 19, verse 8. Moses begins this litany of commands in Leviticus 19. He says, each of you must respect your father and mother. Don't steal from each other. Don't lie. Don't deceive one another. Don't defraud your neighbor or rob him. And each of these commands are focusing on the relationship between one another. Now listen to what it says in Leviticus 19, 14 through 18. Listen very carefully to the specific commands that he's giving that leads up to love your neighbors yourself. Because if you know the phrase as love your neighbors yourself, you should know possibly what Jesus is indicting the nation of Israel about. Do not curse the deaf or put a stumbling block in front of the blind, but fear your God. In the last couple of chapters, how have the deaf and blind been treated? You guys follow me on that? Bartimaeus is crying out, have mercy on me, son of David. And how is the blind man treated? Shut your mouth, you evil, shameful man, who obviously being punished by God, for that's why you can't see. Leviticus 19:14. Do not curse the deaf or put a stumbling block in front of the blind, but fear your God. I am the Lord. Do not pervert justice. Do not show partiality to the poor or favoritism to the great, but judge your neighbor fairly. Sound familiar? Hello? What was just a couple chapters earlier? This really rich young man coming to Jesus and saying, hey, I want to be a part of your kingdom. And whenever Jesus says, give everything you have to the poor, how do the disciples respond? Well, if he can't make it in, then who can? Why are you showing favoritism to the guy that has a bunch of money? I'm not understanding this. Haven't you read Leviticus? This isn't necessarily a new command. It's just one you're not living out. Do not go about spreading slander among your people. Do not do anything that endangers your neighbor's life. Parable of the vineyard, anybody? I am the Lord. Do not hate your brother in your heart. Do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against one of your people. But love your neighbor as yourself. I find that very ironic. I find it very ironic that literally the command right before love your neighbor as yourself is the very command that the Pharisees and teachers of the law have shown consistently that they're guilty of. For whenever Jesus says the truth of God about them being in cohorts with the laystes, turning God's house of prayer into a place in which they launch a war against the Gentiles against. The vineyard, whenever the people that God sends his doulos are consistently killed and murdered, and even his own son is killed and murdered, their response is, let's arrest him and figure out a way to kill him. And Jesus says, haven't you read Leviticus? Haven't you read Leviticus? Apparently not. Or maybe you have it memorized. You just don't want to live it out. You see? It doesn't answer, though, how the second is like the first. It just tells us what the second is, right? How is the second like the first? If you want to accomplish the first, you do it by doing the second. Why is it that in the Ten Commandments, God gives the first four that belong to this relationship, the first greatest commandment, and then he spends the last six talking about this relationship? It says, because they're intricately woven. I love the, oh man, 1 John. John's my favorite apostle for multiple reasons. But one of the reasons why is because he just doesn't pull any punches. He just tells you how it is. 1 John 4:20 through 21 is probably one of my favorite passages. I've got a couple now. But he says, if anyone says, I love God, the first greatest commandment, yet hates his brother, he is a liar. It's like whenever Mark preached a sermon this past Tuesday, and he just flat out said, you're a liar. I was like, man, you sound like John. Sound an awful lot like John. Anyone who says, I love God, yet hates his brother, he is a liar. For anyone who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. And he has given us this command. Listen to the command that John gives us. Whoever loves God must also love his brother. What has he done? He's taken the two greatest commandments and made them one. Because in John's mind, they are one. How do you love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all of your mind, with all of your strength? By loving those around you. By taking care of the poor. By looking after the widows. By fighting for the least of these and not for yourself. Man, I got really frustrated and a little bit of in trouble, but I was okay with it. For my dorm, theme for one of the years whenever I was here at Ozark. And I didn't get in too much trouble, but I got mildly rebuked for speaking out against the theme because I was not a fan. That's funny. Anyway, where was I at? Oh, the theme for our dorm was I Choose Third. I Choose Third. And it came from this passage. Love the Lord God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, the first greatest commandment. Love your neighbor as yourself, second greatest commandment. And then the theme was, so I choose third. And my frustration was, I was like, you're missing the heart of that passage. It's not saying you're third. It's saying you don't exist. That you pour everything that you have out for God and for others. And you're just not on the radar. If you use this passage to ask the question, where am I now? You're misunderstanding the kingdom. You following my heart in that? Why is it that whenever God says, give everything to me and to others, we say, okay, so what position am I in? No, you've given everything. You don't even exist without your relationship between you and God and you and others that defines you. And in the moment that you realize it defines you, the moment that you realize what really defines you is you completely in self-abnegation. Complete self-denial so that others can be taken care of before you and maybe even in front of you or in spite of you. Does that make sense? In other words, I think what Jesus is saying more than anything is eradicate the I and a lot of the kingdom will start to make sense to you. But the problem is you're constantly wondering, where am I in this situation? Stop asking that question and ask, where is God's heart bleeding in this situation? And how are others being mistreated? Those questions will lead you to the kingdom. But asking, where am I, won't even come close to what the kingdom wants you, where that wants you to be. I choose third. No, you don't. There is no greater commandment than greater than these. All the Old Testament's been driving to this. Well said, teacher. See, you see kind of my little bit of attention in this passage with this guy? Well said, teacher. Ooh, don't use the word teacher. The man replied, you are right in saying that God is one. Monotheism, definitely championed. And there is no other but Him. Love the Lord your God, or the Lord our God, the Lord is one. To love Him with all of your heart and with all of your understanding, with all of your strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself is more important than all burnt offerings and sacrifices. What did he add? What did he add? Understanding. What else, though? More important than all burnt offerings and sacrifices. That's an important detail which creates the tension a little more. I do have a tension with the fact he calls Jesus teacher. Because I'm going, oh, that shows me that you're functioning out of ignorance over one key issue. And yet whenever he adds the more than burnt offerings and sacrifices, all of a sudden I'm going, but he does get the system of the kingdom. Because where is he getting this one, where is he getting this phrase from? What is he alluding to? Does anybody know what passage? It's a powerful one. Matter of fact, let's just turn there. Turn to Isaiah chapter 1. While you're turning there, let me just kind of reflect on some of the things he's just said by more than burnt offerings and sacrifices. Number one, one of the things I think it's pretty interesting that he's connecting is he's possibly saying what you stopped in chapter 11 by driving out all the people from the temple, when you stopped the sacrifices and offerings, that was not a completely inaccurate thing to do. Because he is possibly saying, making a statement about the current state of the nation of Israel. You're right. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbors yourself is not something we're doing well. For those are more important than burnt offerings and sacrifices. He may be reflecting on the cleansing of the temple. It's possible. And if he is, he may be saying, I actually somewhat agree with your assessment of where we're at. It's possible. You see how that could be read into that? Because what did Jesus' cleansing of the temple accomplish? Stopping the burnt offerings and sacrifices. Second thing is, this probably shows that this guy definitely is a Pharisee. Because his allusion is to Isaiah 1, a passage a Sadducee would not have felt comfortable with, because it wasn't in the first five books. And if he is alluding to Isaiah chapter 1, he is possibly admitting that the state of Israel is currently in a state of rebellion. And this is why. Let's read Isaiah 1. We're going to read, I think, 26 verses. But we're going to read it in such a manner where I want you to hear very clearly what this guy is alluding to. You hear me? You hear my heart in this? This is essential to understanding what he is saying and what Jesus is indicting them for. Hear, O heavens. Listen, O earth, for the Lord has spoken. I reared children and brought them up. But they have rebelled against me. Kind of sounds like the parable of the vineyard, doesn't it? The ox knows his master, the donkey his owner's manger. But Israel does not know. My people do not understand. They have eyes to see, but they don't hear. They have ears to hear, but they are not hearing. A sinful nation. A people loaded with guilt. A brood of evildoers. Children given to corruption. They have forsaken the Lord. They have spurned the Holy One of Israel and turned their backs on Him. Why should you be beaten anymore? Why do you persist in rebellion? Your whole head is injured. Your whole heart is afflicted. From the sole of your foot to the top of your head, there is no soundness. Only wounds and welts and open sores, not cleansed or bandaged or soothed with oil. Your country is desolate. Your cities burned with fire. Your fields are being stripped by foreigners right before you, laid waste as when overthrown by strangers. The daughter of Zion is left like a shelter in a vineyard, like a hut in a field of melons, like a city under siege. Unless the Lord Almighty had left us some survivors, we would have become like Sodom. We would have been like Gomorrah. Hear the word of the Lord, you rulers of Sodom. Now who is he calling Sodom? Israel. Listen to the law of our God, you people of Gomorrah. The multitude of your sacrifices, what are they to me? Says the Lord. I have more than enough of burnt offerings, of rams, and the fat of fattened animals. I have no pleasure in the blood of bulls and lambs and goats. When you come to appear before me, who has asked this of you, this trampling of my courts, stop bringing meaningless offerings. Your incense is detestable to me. New moons, Sabbaths, and convocations, I cannot bear your evil assemblies. Your new moon festivals and your appointed feast, my soul hates. They have become a burden to me. and I am weary of bearing them. When you spread out your hands in prayer, I will hide my eyes from you. Even if you offer many prayers, I will not listen. Your hands are full of blood. Wash and make yourselves clean. Take your evil deeds out of my sight. Stop doing wrong. Learn to do right. Seek justice. Encourage the oppressed. Defend the cause of the fatherless. Plead the case of the widow. Come now, let us reason together, people of God. Though your sins are like scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. Though they are red as crimson, they shall be like wool. If you are willing and obedient, you will eat the best from the land. But if you resist and rebel, you will be devoured by the sword, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. That's what this guy has just alluded to. Do you hear the indictment in that passage? Because even though it's written in the time of Isaiah, it sounds like something that could be used to level an indictment against the people of the nation of Israel in Jesus' day, does it not? For how are they treating the oppressed and the poor, the fatherless and the widows? Matter of fact, we'll just get to at the very end of this section, there will be the widow's offering where Jesus would use this as an example of the righteous and holiness of His kingdom as compared to the one that is currently reigning. Remember. Isaiah goes on in verse 21 through 26, describing the leaders of the nation. See how the faithful city has become a harlot? Isaiah starts off in 1:21. You see how the faithful city has become a prostitute? She once was full of justice. Righteousness used to dwell in her. But now, murderers. Your silver has become dross. Your choice wine is diluted with water. You rulers are rebels, companion with laestace. They all love bribes and chase after gifts. They do not defend the cause of the fatherless. The widow's case does not come before them. Therefore, the Lord Almighty, the Mighty One of Israel, declares, "Ah, I will get my relief from my foes and avenge myself on my enemies." Who are His enemies? The rebellious leaders of His people are His enemies in Isaiah chapter 1, verses 21 through 26. I will turn my hand against you. I will thoroughly purge away your dross and remove all your impurities. I will restore your judges as in the days of old, your counselors as at the beginning. Jesus says, I am so glad you refer to that passage. Because not only does it show what is wrong with this nation, it also shows what God's desire is. And that is to restore them not back to a kingdom run by you, but to a kingdom like that of the time of Judges. Whenever God was the one that brought about the people at the times He wanted to bring them about to accomplish what He wanted to accomplish and how He wanted to accomplish it. For Isaiah 1 says, a time's coming when God will be back in control. And there's nothing that you rebellious people can do about it. In response to what this man alludes to, Jesus says in verse 34 of Mark 12, when Jesus saw that he had answered wisely, he said to him, man, you're not far from the kingdom of God after all. What is the guy missing though? He understands the problem of their current is the nation of Israel. He understands that something new needs to happen because what they are worshiping is not what God is desiring. And what they are doing as a nation is the exact opposite of what God has created them to be and to do. But what is he missing? Teacher, he doesn't know who Jesus is. See the issue? Jesus says, man, you're so close. If you just knew who I was, you'd have all the pieces to this puzzle. You just don't know who I am. Which is indicative of the fact that you just called me teacher. I'm not just a teacher. I mean, that's a part of what I do, That's not who I am. I'm bigger than that. And that's the issue that Jesus now brings up. And when he asks the question in a counterattack to the teachers of the law. And from then on, no one dared ask him any more questions. Yeah, the question route hasn't been going very well. So eventually they'll just kill him. Verse 35, while Jesus was teaching in the temple courts, still on their home turf, he asked, how is it that the teachers of the law say that the Christ is the son of David? Notice his question is about his identity. Because what was the teacher of the law just lacking? Understanding who Jesus is. David himself, speaking by the Holy Spirit, declared, and he quotes now from Psalm 110, verse 1, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I put your enemies under your feet. David himself calls the Christ Lord. How then can he be his son? See, son has the connotation of subjection or lower in honor than the father. Because who can surpass the master or the father in honor? Not the son, for the son even receives his honor, it's ascribed from his father. And he says, but if that's true, then why is David, if your system is right, then why is David seeming to contradict your system whenever he calls the son of David, the Christ, Lord? The large crowd listened with delight. Listened with delight. Why does Mark put that detail in there? Because we have to have the answer to the honor game. And the crowd's always the one that gives the verdict. Always. Jesus, in this question to them, he literally looks at them and he says, my honor actually exceeds that of David, and David said so himself. If you knew who I was, you would know that I do have the right to be saying the things I'm saying. If you knew who I was and by what authority I was speaking, you would know that I have the right to take the kingdom away from you and give it to those that are obedient. You would know I have the right to stop sacrifices. You would know I would even have the right to pronounce judgment on the temple itself, which is what chapter 13 will dominate after your test next Wednesday. Your test's on Tuesday, by the way. Read your syllabus. Jesus looks at me and says, honestly, the problem is you just don't know who I am. But if you did, you'd realize my honor was even higher than that of David's. And the crowds look at him and they say, man, you are winning this honor war. You're killing it. We're loving this. For a little bit longer. Ultimately, here's the thing that you can take away. And it's this. You can know what's wrong with the system. And you can memorize large portions of the books that belong to the system. And you can get A's on every test you possibly take at Ozark and still not know who Jesus is. If you don't know who he is, you're missing the key thing. You are close to the kingdom, but you are not a part of it. Because you both have to understand who he is and what kind of kingdom he's establishing. And if you don't get both pieces right, you don't have the whole story. Love you guys. See you on Tuesday. For the